listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Happy Friday. To put together today's podcast, I had a conversation, three different conversations throughout the week with, first on Monday was with Stephanie Taub. She's an attorney with First Liberty Institute. Then on Thursday, I had a conversation with State Auditor Rob Sand. And this morning, I spoke with former Congressman David Young about his 2020 election bid in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District. Before we get to all of that, first, a word from our sponsor, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
And I'm back. I appreciate American Principles Project's sponsorship of this podcast. If you are interested in sponsoring Caffeinated Thoughts, either our website or the podcast, just shoot me an email, shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com, or give me a call, 515-321-5077. I'd love to talk with you about our different opportunities, which I think would be a win-win for both of us. So please drop me a line or give me a call if you're interested. Well, on Monday, as I mentioned before, I had a conversation with Stephanie Taub. She's an attorney with First Liberty Institute. She and I talked about a new rule that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services finalized that would protect healthcare workers' religious conscience, especially or specifically as it deals with abortion and I believe, I'm trying to remember now, Monday seems to be such a long time ago, as well as end-of-life care, but that's not appropriate, assisted suicide. So we discussed why that was important. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Stephanie Taub. Well, hey, Stephanie, thank you for joining us on the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very welcome. So I want to ask you, basically the Department of Health and Human Services finalized a rule that provides conscience protections for healthcare workers. What all does this involve?
So that's right. The Department of Health and Human Services' new rule protects conscience rights in healthcare. It ensures that 25 existing conscience protections that are already then codified in law are actually enforceable. So these are primarily protecting healthcare providers in three areas, those healthcare providers that have objections to abortion, sterilization, and euthanasia. So this is a very important rule to protect the conscience rights of healthcare professionals.
Okay, you said it was codified before. When did that happen and why wasn't it being enforced?
So that's a good question. So essentially there are 25 different statutes that Congress has passed, and some of these have been on the books for decades. So some of them, like the Church Amendment, have been on the books for quite a long time. And essentially, what this new rule is doing is making sure that they're all gathered all in one place, and that the Department of Health and Human Services is actually able to investigate and receive complaints regarding any sort of violation of any of these different statutes.
Okay, well, do you know personally, has First Liberty Institute represented anybody that has been forced to perform an abortion or sterilization or assisted suicide?
Well, we've definitely counseled people that were worried about being discriminated against because of their pro-life beliefs in the healthcare arena. And so the rules like this are very important because they make sure that doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals basically aren't going to be foreclosed from entering entire realms of the healthcare industry. Because if they are being forced to decide between their job or performing a service such as abortion that they believe is unethical, then many people just won't go into that healthcare industry at all. So that's why this rule is very important.
Okay. Are there any particular states that would have been, you know, more difficult than others when it comes before this rule is passed? And I guess does this impact the state level?
Yeah, it does. So basically, this applies to a wide variety of healthcare entities that receive federal funds, which is a large percentage of the healthcare industry. And then you asked about particular states that might be affected. So we know that there have been nurses in Illinois and New York and New Jersey that have been that have filed lawsuits about being forced to participate in abortions. And so this could definitely have impacts in those states and in basically across the United States.
Okay. And do you know if the department is looking into expanding religious conscience protections to other areas such as, for instance, you know, we're looking at the Equality Act and that could potentially end up forcing hospitals and physicians to, and surgeons to, get involved in sex reassignment surgeries or, you know, provide transitioning services, whether it's, you know, as far as, medical treatments for those who identify as transgender. Do you know if the Department of Health and Human Services is looking at protecting healthcare professionals from that aspect as well?
Well, we do know that this bill doesn't really move the ball. It doesn't affect the existing statutory protections. So it's really focused on abortion, sterilization, and euthanasia. And there are a few other provisions that are involved in some of the various other statutes. I know that this rule has been miscategorized by some people to say that it goes further than it does. But it's really well written to just mirror what the statutory protections that are already on the books. I know that the Department of Health and Human Services is considering other laws. I know that there are other laws that are out for either public comment or that will soon be released. I think Roger Severino has announced that they are looking at a rule that has to do with the Affordable Care Act and its interpretation of discrimination. So we'll be anxious to see what that rule says when it comes out.
I'm assuming that's going to address basically forcing folks to cover birth control as well as abortifacient medication
for the one that has to do with the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Well, we know the Obama administration, right before they left office, they issued a rule that was very broadly interpreting the definition of sex discrimination, and so that rule was preliminary enjoined by a district court. And so it hasn't been gone into effect essentially since it was issued by the department.
Okay, tell me a little bit about First Liberty Institute. How long you guys been around? What do you do? And how can people get involved supporting your organization?
First Liberty Institute is a nonprofit law firm dedicated to defending religious liberty for all Americans. We represent people of all faiths, and we never charge our clients. And so we are happy to be involved in protecting healthcare professionals who believe that their conscience rights are in danger of being infringed.
Great. Well, hey, thank you so much. Is there anything else that we should know about this before I let you go?
I think that's about it. We're grateful to this administration for protecting religious liberty. And without rules like this, people might be foreclosed from entire swaths of the healthcare industry. So healthcare professionals, this is very important for to prevent discrimination.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
I have to say, I am very thankful for the Trump administration's work on behalf of religious liberty. There's a number of things that that President Trump's administration has implemented to better protect religious liberty. So I want to give credit where credit is due, and that he has done that. He's followed through on his promises in that area. So I want to be, you know,
I said before my how I'm ever gonna how I'll handle President Trump is I'll praise things that I think he needs to be praised for, and criticize him where I think he needs to be criticized. And certainly, this area is where he needs to be praised. His administration has done some fabulous work. There are a number of things that need to be, I think, codified eventually by Congress. There's only so much you could do by executive order that's going to last. But this particular executive order just essentially put into effect federal law that the Obama administration really did not enforce. So, again, kudos to President Trump. Moving on with my conversation with Rob Sin. I've known Rob. Oh, we've been following each other on Twitter at least a couple of years, I think. I met him for the first time face-to-face last year. He and I had lunch on a couple different occasions. Full disclosure, you know, he's a Democrat. I did not vote for him in 2018. I'm not saying I've never voted for a Democrat before. I have for some nonpartisan offices in the past. Like not very often. I think I could think of twice on top of my head where I voted for a Democrat. So I didn't vote for Rob because mainly not because I thought he was necessarily going to do a bad job. It's just I was happy with the job Mary Mosman was doing. So I voted for her. But I appreciate Rob coming on not only this podcast, but also he has reached out to me on several occasions, and we've had some good dialogue back and forth, and I appreciate that. And I think our relationship is something that is symbolic of something I'd like to see happen more often, not only with myself but maybe with other people. More constructive dialogue with people we disagree. I'm not saying I disagree with Rob on everything. There's definitely a number of issues that he and I disagree on. Not necessarily related to the state auditor position, however. And I will go on the record and say this, that I am keeping an open mind for 2022 down the road for voting for him for re-election. If he does a good job. Now, if he turns into a partisan hack in the job, now he may be a partisan hack on his Twitter account, his personal Twitter account, and that's fine. As long as if he doesn't bring it into the job, that's fine. Now, not to say I would vote for him if he ran for state legislature, not that he would do that, or Congress or Senate down the road, because, you know, our disagreements on policy would, I think, make an impact in those roles. So, but something like, you know, I would like, if I ran for office, I'm sure he probably wouldn't vote for me either. But on an issue with state, with what the state auditor's office handles, there's a lot of room for agreement. And I think you'll find this conversation we had there, I don't think we disagreed at all, actually. So I hope you find this conversation I had with Rob informative. I really like the guy. And I think we need to have more conversations like this. And so hope you enjoy the conversation.
Rob Sin, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Thanks for having me, Shane. I appreciate it.
Very welcome. I have to say, you are the third Democrat to either be on my radio program, when I had a radio program, or the podcast. So there's few of you willing to come on, and I appreciate that, your willingness to do that.
Well, I'm bummed there's not more. I'm a big believer that if we're going to work together to fix our problems, we're going to have to start talking to each other for starters.
Right. Part of that's me too. I assume people aren't willing to come on, so I don't extend an invitation.
Yeah. It's probably a little bit like, dating. If you're used to getting turned down after a while, you're probably like, well, I don't even want to ask anymore.
I was going to say, I had a lot of experience with that in high school, but people don't want to hear about that. They want to hear about, okay. You've been state auditor now since January. When you were elected and first day on the job, you know, like what's your approach? What are the ideas that you're trying to implement? How are you different from Mary Mosman?
Sure. All good questions. I think one of the big things, you know, I obviously there's a number of issues that I campaigned on. And we're making progress on a lot of those. One is this office has always had the authority to promote efficiency in government, to make recommendations on how to save money at the state level and the county and local level. We are going to be doing that. I just did a town hall tour to collect feedback from people across the state on our PIE checklist. It's public innovations and efficiencies. And so that's just a checklist that we can use to promote money-saving practices across government levels. So our office is, for the first time, going to be using that authority regularly with the audits that we do. So that's one thing, you know, I campaigned on that I said I wanted to do, and we're doing it. Another one is making – go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, I think that's something that, you know, conservatives and liberals, everybody should be able to get behind. I
mean, yeah, which
– government to be more efficient.
Yeah, and honestly, that's part of the reason I wanted to do it right away. I think it's really important that elected officials try to serve the whole state and try to serve everyone and try to make their focus be on things that are less controversial that benefit everyone. And so starting with that was a good thing. Another piece is I thought that the office needed more professional diversity to bring in some folks with a law enforcement background. So we have worked with DAS, that's the Department of Administrative Services.
Mm-hmm.
Tap, tap, I'm trying to wake you up again. And they helped us promote a new or create a new job description and a new job position for an auditor investigator, someone with a law enforcement background.
Okay, so
got that. Go ahead.
Yeah, tell me about that. I know that some people criticize you for that during the election, that idea. And I'm just curious, what added benefit does it does that bring to your office, having somebody from a law enforcement background when, say, you know, financial crimes, you could just hand off to the Iowa, you know, the Attorney General's office, because you used to handle stuff like that, right, when you were in the Attorney General office?
I handled, that was my main job description, basically, chief financial crimes prosecutor for the state. And that experience is precisely why I understand that you do need to have someone with that sort of experience in this office. I know a lot of people can look at it from the outside and say, oh, well, you do financial audits. Why do you need someone with a law enforcement background? Well, let me tell you, as someone with a law enforcement background myself, you need to have people preparing these special investigations, the public corruption investigations, who know what questions need to be asked from a law enforcement perspective on day one. You got to have somebody in there who the whole time is thinking, is this going to hold up in court? Did I ask that legally required question? That sort of stuff. Because if you don't, then when you're on the tail end, the fact that you didn't have law enforcement involved from the beginning might mean you lose.
Okay, interesting. So are you looking at attorneys? Are you looking at, you know, law enforcement officers? I mean, what is this person?
Yeah, what we're looking at is law enforcement officers, folks with a law enforcement background, you know, police, sheriff's deputy, that sort of thing, maybe military police. We've already got myself as a criminal prosecutor and my chief of staff, John McCormley, who's done a great job here and was doing a great job at the AG's office. He's done criminal prosecution as well. So between he and I, we don't really need another attorney with criminal prosecution. I think two for these purposes is enough for that. But I think we need someone over there day in, day out, who's working on these investigations, making sure that those questions are getting asked.
Okay. Another thing that I know you took some heat for in the election from Republicans in particular, is you don't have a CPA.
Mm-hmm.
How what's the workaround for that? How are you getting, how are you working the office without being a CPA yourself?
There's literally no workaround because there's literally no problem. That was a line of criticism that was used that I questioned it at the time. I reached out directly to my opponent, said, hey, that it's, you know, the line was, you're not a CPA, and so the office can't issue audits if you're not a CPA, meaning it can't do its work and, you know, the world will fall apart. I reached out and said, hey, that's not true. I'm happy to explain to you legally why it's not true. I never really got afforded that opportunity, so it ended up being something we talked about the entire campaign. It wasn't true. We're issuing our audits. We're doing all the work we normally do. We have 30 CPAs in the office, I think. I know it was a little over 30 before the election, but we've got right about that number. We don't need another one. You know, we've got two CPAs at least that look at every one of the audits that go out of the office. Having a third one doesn't add a lot. On the other side, it's actually kind of helpful to have another attorney in the office, because then you can, instead of simply doing a public purpose test where a person who's trained as a CPA asks mm-hmm. whether or not a particular check that's getting written has a public purpose, you can have an attorney look at that and say, is it actually in compliance, and do a compliance test where you read the law related to the question and actually have more of an opinion as to whether or not it had a legal basis.
Okay. Okay.
So it hasn't been, there's been nothing to work around, and I think a lot of folks in the office have been satisfied that it's actually been beneficial.
Okay. You recently had a statement that you're launching an investigation into spread pricing in Medicaid. Could you talk to us about that, and just pretend that I know nothing about it, because that would be
sure.
an accurate assessment.
No problem. Spread pricing is like this. Imagine that instead of the state buying drugs, prescription drugs, for people on Medicaid, this is a car dealing setup, okay? So you mm-hmm. walk in and you say to the middleman, hello, I would like a four-door red car with good gas mileage.
Okay.
And they say, okay, here you go. And they give you a four-door red Ford that has good gas mileage. And then they turn around and charge the state for a four-door red Ferrari that gets good gas mileage.
Gotcha.
The difference is really, you know, it's the product is same between the brand name version of the drug and the generic. There's no
uh-huh.
real difference. But in spread pricing, what they're doing is they're using the drug that is the generic, and yet charging taxpayers for the brand name version, for the more expensive, the higher end kind.
Now, you cited this as something that was going on in Ohio. Has there been instances found in Iowa?
Yeah, they've found it across the United States. It's been problematic in West Virginia as well. And yeah, John Forbes, who's a state rep in Urbandale and a pharmacist, actually did a little preliminary audit himself with information from his own pharmacy, and mm-hmm. found spread pricing, which to me is enough to say, okay, then we need to do a fuller investigation. If this is, you know, a case that I was looking at as a prosecutor, not that I'm not suggesting that there's criminal wrongdoing here, but there's enough evidence here to say that we need to do a full investigation.
Okay. Now, what steps have you taken to begin the process of, I'm sure you're going to eventually audit the managed care organizations involved with Medicaid. Have you already taken steps to do that, or is that, you know, down the road?
So we've got a couple. What we can kind of do is tell folks that we have got audits open, but discussing publicly how
sure,
far along
yeah.
we are, what specifics we're doing, we actually are prohibited from doing that under Chapter 11 of the Iowa Code.
Well, I certainly
so I can
wouldn't
tell you
want
that
you to
we...
wouldn't want you to break
right,
the
no,
law.
No, no. Yeah. So I can tell you that we're doing this audit of the prescription benefit managers, the PBMs, on spread pricing. I can tell you that we're working on issues related to Medicaid, but getting into the specifics there, I just am, you know, it's the sort of thing that I can talk about when we issue the report, and until we issue it, we can't really do it much or say
okay.
much.
Fair enough. Your greatest fan, Jeff Kaufman, has been talking about your tour and your criticism of Joni Ernst. And,
yeah.
you know, just can we, are you running for office in 2020?
I'm not planning to, and I'm not thinking seriously about it.
Okay, fair enough. So you're basically the tour is you know, because honestly, I noticed when you announced the tour, it's like, you know, I've never seen a state auditor do a tour like this. I haven't seen any
right.
any state elected official other than say the governor do a tour like this. So it was unique. I'm not saying
yeah.
it's wrong. I think elected officials should get out and meet with constituents. Why do you think
yeah.
why do you think people don't do town halls? And why are you
know
kind of breaking that mold?
It's work. It takes work to plan them. It takes work to get people to attend them. It takes extra time. I was on the road away from my family, my wife and my two kids, who are two boys, 2.5 and 5 years old, away from them for 3 days straight. I slept on, I had a bed both nights, but you know, just like sleeping in a friend's guest room. It's not necessarily fun to do. But here's the thing. It's important. If I want to do a good job with our PIE initiative, Public Innovations and Efficiencies, I want to hear from the public when I have something to show them. We brought around our pie chart. We asked people, what do you think about this? What should we have on there? What should we not have on there? And because we did that work, that first go-round is going to be significantly the better than it would have been otherwise. And
right.
It's sort of depressing to me, Shane, to see that here we are, we got people on the left and the right and in the middle who just are disgusted with government, who are continually disappointed with their public servants. And when somebody does something that takes some real initiative to do something, it's met with suspicion. I think that is the saddest thing, that like, oh, you're about to announce for another office. Like, no, I just really want this to work and I want to do a good job, but you can, I guess, think whatever you want about it. I'm going to do it anyways.
Okay. I actually defended you on Twitter.
Oh no, I don't mean you personally.
No, personally. No,
I remember that you defended me, and I appreciated that. I just
yeah,
mean for the
I'm
people
just
out
asking.
There that were like, ah, he's running.
Well,
like, no,
yeah.
I just want to do a good job.
No, I was going to follow up and say that I think it's a good idea. Now,
yeah.
I think if you were just going out doing a stump speech, then we'd be like, But
yeah, that'd be silly.
But the fact you're talking about, assessments
yeah.
and I mean, it's not exactly your typical political fair. So
no, it is not. It is far afield from it. And I think, for even if we didn't have a new initiative, going out and talking to folks and just answering questions from the public, my goodness, every elected official, like you said, we ought to be doing it more.
Right. Well, every legislators, they hold.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
District. So it's not unheard of. It's just in the state auditor's office. Now, somebody pointed out to me, I think, David Vaught, he went around and talked to different Rotary clubs and chamber groups. And I know Mary Mosman probably talked to some groups as well, but that's not exactly the same thing as saying, hey, I'm going to just
yeah,
meet.
That's right.
Here's a specific location and Joe Public can come. What kind of response did you see when you were out?
Honestly, our Council Bluffs one specifically is what government in Iowa ought to look like. You had a statewide elected official coming to a town and having elected officials from the opposite party of that town and from the opposite party of that county coming to the event and having an exchange of ideas, literally ideas, as to how to make government work better together. And if no one else had shown up for the other 12 town halls across the state, that alone would have made it worth it. But we had good events at every stop. One only had a couple people there, but one of the guys there was on the local airport board and had a couple of good ideas that he brought, and it was still worth it.
Interesting. Okay. Hey, you just had a today. You had a statement about the federal courthouse moving in Des Moines. That seems like something unusual for a state auditor to talk about. What's going on there?
I have been inside that building, and it is gorgeous. You walk in and you just think, wow.
We have really had some truly incredible facilities here. That
really make our federal courthouse something that is, it's beautiful. And the idea that we're going to take $137 million in taxpayer money and build another one across the river, three blocks away, is bonkers.
Well, and they're looking at the Y property, or old Y property.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
So,
yeah.
So, not only are they taking taxpayer money to do that, but they're also taking prime riverfront property that could be taxed.
That's right.
So, Which is, you know, it just seems like an odd use for that.
Yeah, it puts upward pressure on property taxes at the local level and the county level. Yeah, because then you have that other chunk that isn't going to be taxed. But it's a beautiful building. It's beautiful. And I wanted to go down there because, I wanted to see if we could get some footage on the news to show people, literally so that Iowans can see how nice that building is. Now, there's a restriction. Legally, you're not allowed to film inside the building, which I think is crazy. And I'm hoping maybe they'll allow some pictures to be published from the inside of it. But I think Iowans deserve to see the inside of that building, too.
Right. I've never been inside, but my wife has. And my understanding is you're not even allowed to bring your cell phone in.
Correct. Unless you are a member of the bar, you can't bring a cell phone in. You can't bring a camera in. Nothing like that.
Crazy. Yeah, that seems really, really odd for transparency's sake. I mean, obviously during a court hearing, you know, I know there are rules against cameras and rightfully so in certain circumstances, but just to be able to video the inside of the building.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's probably some security reasons for that, but it still seems to be above and beyond what's necessary.
Yeah, it doesn't. I don't think that's good public policy, generally speaking. But especially when you're having a public debate about whether or not you should build a new courthouse, the condition of the one that you're already sitting in is kind of important question.
Right. Yeah, and from the outside, and I've never been in, but the outside looks nice. So yeah, it seems odd that they're wanting to move it. I don't know if they need to. Are they just running out of space? I guess I really haven't heard the reasons why they want.
They're not running out of space, and in fact, with the new one across the river, they wouldn't even move the U.S. Attorney's office, which means the people who are prosecuting the alleged criminals. You know, they might be prosecuting a case against a drug cartel. They're going to have to walk across a bridge in downtown Des Moines in the middle of the day to and from the courthouse where they're going to be prosecuting defendants.
Oh, that seems, you know, smart.
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you, I mean, and you know, they could move them to a different building, but that's just going to be another additional cost. It's crazy.
Yeah, that is nuts.
So to me, you know, we do audits of federal money if it's spent through state agencies. And obviously we have some role in local and county. And so with all three of those combined, with the spending of the federal money and also with how it affects the taxes at the local level in Des Moines and in Polk County, you know, if I have the ability to stand up and say, this is a really bad use of taxpayer money, I'm going to take it.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate it. This is something I think the conservatives and liberals can agree on, and heck, we've agreed a lot today, Rob, on a number of things. So
I'm a pretty
amazing.
Reasonable guy.
Second last question, how's your working relationship with Governor Reynolds?
You know, we had a fine meeting back in January, just when we were both sworn in. I thought that went well. Her general counsel is a guy named Sam Langholz, who's a friend of mine that I respect greatly. He's a very bright guy. We knew each other in law school. He was, I think, 2 years ahead of me. But just a solid guy, and so it's nice to have him there because I think that helps us have a relationship of trust there.
All right. Well, last question, because this is the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast, what's your favorite coffee drink?
Black, just straight up black coffee.
Good man. Good man.
I'm pretty simple.
We'll have to go out for a cup sometime soon. So, hey.
Yeah, let's do that.
If there's any, I'll let you go unless there's something else you want to mention before I let you go.
No, just thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it very much. Absolutely.
Very welcome. Well, take care.
All right.
And have a great
thanks,
weekend.
Shane.
All right.
Yep. Bye-bye. You too. Bye.
This morning I had a conversation with former Congressman David Young, who recently announced he's running for Congress once again in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District, going to challenge Congresswoman Cindy Axne, who defeated him in 2018. A conversation we had earlier in the week,
before this, he made a comment to me that I think is important to remember. I inadvertently said, and people have said, that he's trying to win back his seat. And he said, I want to make sure everybody knows this is not my seat. But this is the people's seat. So he's spot on there, and I appreciate him saying that. He's trying to win the opportunity to represent those of us who live in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District once again. He served in Congress 2 terms between 2015 and 2019. He won election in 2014 pretty easily after a very contested Republican primary where he won the nomination in a special nominating convention. And then he won re-election in 2016 handedly. So it's going to be a challenge. And he talks about how he's approaching the race and his thoughts on it. We talk about a variety of different things. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Congressman David Young.
Congressman Young, welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Shane. Always a pleasure.
So you announced that you were running again in 2020 for the Iowa 3rd Congressional District, and you want to challenge Congresswoman Cindy Axne, who defeated you in 2018. And I guess a question that I have, and probably a lot of my listeners might have, is how are you going to approach this campaign differently, and how are you going to address some of the for instance, in the suburbs, we saw a shift towards Democrats from, the top of the ticket on down?
Well, first of all, you see what's happening right now with what's going on in Congress. And, back in 2018 in November, the Democrats put a lot of candidates out there who had not served before and didn't have a voting record. And now Cindy Axne has a voting record, and it's not good. And we'll be able to make sure that we talk about that. And there's some significant differences. Cindy Axne was the only one in the country in the House who won a seat by less than 50% of the vote. So she did not get a majority of the vote. She got a plurality. And the Democrats really had a strong voter turnout in Polk County and Dallas County. And the Republican voter rate was not where it should be, and that's unfortunate. A lot of people, I think, stayed home because they were maybe sitting back and maybe not happy with what was happening, or waiting for the Mueller report, or things were good economically and they didn't sense a need to get out and vote, that kind of thing. But we are starting to address these issues now, and I'm not going to give you any kind of campaign strategy, but we have new leadership in Polk County. Yeah, we have new leadership in Polk County at the Iowa GOP. We've got new leadership as well in Dallas County. And I've been all around the district, and, when you're in the majority, you get a little bit complacent. We have the White House, the Governor's Mansion. We had both legislatures in the Iowa Capitol and in the U.S. Congress, and when you're on top, you're not as motivated maybe because you're already there. But, we are motivated now to get this seat back in GOP hands in the U.S. House of Representatives in Iowa's 3rd District. And I've won it twice before, and we're going to have the president on the ticket this time, and that'll drive out a lot of a lot of the discussion and the votes. And Joni Ernst will be on the ticket as well, which is great. I was on the ticket with her as well in 2014. And I'm in the race, and we need to make sure that Iowa's priorities and people's priorities are being focused on. And right now, Shane, if you see what's happening, one of the things that they started out with was a bill that took Iowans work hard, and they pay their taxes, and they expect their taxes to be used for essential services to serve them. But H.R. 1, this bill, Cindy Axne voted to enrich her personal campaign with taxpayer dollars. That bill took taxpayer dollars to go to political campaigns, and that means that people have direct contradictory beliefs of politicians. They're forced to subsidize them and their beliefs, which act in contradiction to their own beliefs. And now, Shane, there's chatter about, I don't know if you've read, they're talking about giving themselves a pay raise in Congress.
I've not heard that.
Congress has ignored the will of the people and their issues, and they're just trying to help themselves right now.
Well,
and I'm not going to let that happen.
Their new one of their new freshman members, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, said that she is unable to afford living in D.C. and in New York. So, maybe it's to help her pay her rent in D.C. You think?
Well, I don't know. You hear a lot from her, but I know that Congress does not deserve a pay raise. They certainly don't. Until they can get the budget balanced and things like that and start working on their issues, what needs to happen is, if anything, when the budget goes on and it's not balanced, maybe their pay should be deducted.
Hmm. Interesting. So looking at, for instance, I found it interesting that Cindy Axne has not weighed in on the Green New Deal. What are your thoughts on the Green New Deal?
I would vote against it. I mean, it would set back America and Iowa decades. It would decimate our economy, and our economy is so strong right now. Listen, we all want to be great stewards of the landscape and the air and the environment that the good Lord gave us. I think we have a calling to do that, and we are doing that with new technologies, new ways of doing things, and fueling and energizing society. We're doing that, and we're leading the world in that. And imagine the chatter about banning the combustible engine and, I mean, airplanes and trains. I mean, how are we going to function? It's ludicrous in my head. And so we need to keep, in Iowa, we're leading the way already in renewable fuels, and we need to be allowed to keep doing that with, biofuels and wind and solar and geothermal. And so we're doing it right now. We're on the right path. Let the markets and let technology and people drive this. We don't need the heavy hand of government regulating us and telling us how to live our lives in
okay.
this way. And Cindy Axne has been a regulator. I mean, she was in the state government at the DNR, and she understands mandates and regulations, and she likes those.
Yeah.
But she isn't telling us where she is on the issue.
Let me ask you about, you mentioned market-based approaches, and I guess one of my chief critiques of the whole renewable fuels movement as a conservative is that, for instance, I see an RFS, a mandate. I also, I see government also putting the thumb on the scale for, things like ethanol. Is there a way to better approach this that does respect the free market?
Well, I think you can get on a glide path to the free market, and I'll give you two examples. The wind production tax credit and the solar tax credits, they're being phased out right now because they were given those tax credits in the beginning. They were going year to year to year, and when you go to year to year to year, you don't get that certainty, and you can't really plan ahead. But when I was serving in my tenure in Congress, we gave – and we worked with the solar industry, and we worked with the wind industry, and we created a glide path off those tax credits, and they agreed to it. They just said, we just need, 5-6 years of certainty, and we can get up and running on our own, and so that's happening. Maybe there's a chance to do that with some of the other renewable energy tax credits. I hope there is at some point. But right now, I do know that with what's going on with trade and kind of hampering some of the agriculture economy, I don't think it would be wise to mess with the renewable fuel standard right now, and we need to get those trade deals done, certainly.
Okay, so are you supportive of right now President Trump's threat to China regarding tariffs?
Well, it's kind of either all or nothing right now. I don't like tariffs, and I know that we need to have those trading partners. We need free and fair trade. China has been a horrible country to deal with when it comes to tariffs. We're hurting their economy right now. And they you can see it in their numbers. You can see it in their production values and up and down the line. I hope the president just uses tariffs as a negotiating tool. But it's all or nothing right now, and it seems to be working. But the question is, our farmers are so gritty and so patriotic, but as someone had recently said, that patriotism doesn't pay the bills sometimes, but they're holding on. And I think we're going to get a good deal here in the end because China is starting to buckle, and we're putting pressure on there. And if China does buckle, just imagine what can be done with just around the world, what can happen with our economy, especially here in Iowa and in the United States of America.
Have you had a chance to look at the United States-Canada-Mexico deal, and what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think we need to pass it. But I do think, and I said this last fall, that they kind of tied up the loose ends of that and put it in a bow last fall. And so it's ready to go, but you need to make sure that you do take those tariffs off of aluminum and steel with Canada and Mexico, because I don't think it's going to get very far into Congress at all, and we can't let that linger. I mean, those are two very, very important trading partners. Mexico has taken some retaliation on our pork industry, and that is very, very important to Iowa. And so I have been recommending and advocating that we take off those tariffs on aluminum and steel with Mexico and Canada and get this rolling.
Okay.
We don't know where Cindy Axne stands on the U.S.-Mexico trade agreement, by the way. That's another thing that we don't know where she
is. That's a good point.
Even the Electoral College. We don't even know where she is on that. I mean, that would really harm Iowa if we got rid of the Electoral College.
Very true. It's amazing how, well, we need to get out and do more civics 101, apparently, because I think people totally don't understand why we have the Electoral College and why it's important to our constitutional republic. That's another thing. Like people keep on referring to the United States as democracy. It's like,
it's a republic.
No, we're a republic, not a democracy. You wouldn't want a pure democracy. You mentioned earlier.
It's battle hymn of the republic, not battle hymn of the democracy.
Right. You mentioned earlier with President Trump at the top of the ticket. I'm just wondering, with the Mueller report coming out, have you had a chance to review any of that?
I admittedly have not read the whole Mueller report. Parts of it have, gone to a lot of sources with synopses of it.
And right.
Even the media, for the most part, is saying, the mainstream media, the more liberal media, admits that there's no collusion in there. And so
right.
I was always in favor of doing the Mueller report, letting it go through the process. No collusion was found, and no obstruction of justice was found as well. But, it looks like this Congress right now and about five committee chairmen in the House just can't let it go. The committee and Congress, they're set to vote against Attorney General Barr on contempt after he failed to comply with a subpoena to see the redacted materials. And, Attorney General Barr and the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure say that you can't disclose grand jury testimony and that information.
Right.
And so the president's claiming executive privilege in regards to that. So there's going to be a showdown, and it may end up in the courts, but it certainly is a showdown, and they just can't help themselves and just admit that, when they trusted Mueller early on and said he's the right person for the job to do this, and then it's just not enough for him.
Right. Well, there wasn't a finding necessarily. There was a decision by Attorney General Barr as well as Deputy AG Rosenstein to, not pursue obstruction charges because of the definition of what would be needed for an obstruction charge at the federal level. But the report itself, Mueller makes a case for Congress, I think, on obstruction, and which is why Democrats are kind of latching onto the whole, possibly an impeachment process. My question to you is, reading through some of the obstruction section, it's not good look for President Trump. And it had the collusion been found, he probably very well would have been facing obstruction charges. What are your thoughts about the whole impeachment process and President Trump's conduct during the Russian investigation? Do you think that's going to have a dampening effect on the 2020 presidential election?
Nobody has that crystal ball and can really tell what's going to happen with all this. But it looks like the Democrats are, Robert Bork had a book called Slouching Towards Gomorrah. And it looks like the Democrats in Congress are slouching towards impeachment. It's just, it's going to go this way, and I think the base will eventually, as they get closer to it, just demand it. And I think some of this does go to the courts regarding the executive privilege and Attorney General Barr saying that he can't disclose this. Maybe some other people have some views on the interpretation of whether or not this can be disclosed or not, and so I think it goes through the courts, but I think it's going to continue to dominate the headlines. Now, with President Trump in Russia, I wish he'd be a little bit more forceful in banging back on Putin and, you know, putting a finger in his face and saying you have been meddling, in a sense, with your propaganda and trying to infiltrate our infrastructure. Fortunately, it was found that Russia did not get into any voting systems and change any votes. But there's no doubt that Russia and probably other countries as well have tried to meddle in elections in a cybersecurity way and in a way with propaganda. And so I think that, you know, one way we can make sure that we, you know, put up our guard is, you know, you see television commercials, campaign commercials, and they have disclosures on them at the bottom about who it was paid for and approved by and that kind of thing. On the internet, that does not exist. You see these ads pop up, and you don't know who's paying them, and you don't know who's behind it. And it could be some nefarious people putting out some false things, trying to sway public opinion. And so I think on internet ads, there needs to be that same kind of disclosure and transparency so we know who's paying for those things.
Well, I think Facebook's actually taking some steps to, you know, do that. I haven't purchased an ad from them recently, but it seems like they have put some guidelines.
Sure. Well, that's great because, yeah, I mean, you know, Facebook, Twitter, you know, those platforms don't have to wait on Congress to tell them to do it. They can be proactive themselves, and that would be good.
So speaking of Facebook and Twitter, Facebook just deplatformed a bunch of folks. I don't really want to say that they're on the right necessarily, because I think some of them are alt-right and, in my mind, not really conservative. And of course, then they also threw Louis Farrakhan in the mix as well. There are calls to say that Facebook, Twitter, Google should be regulated. What are your thoughts on these platforms and how they've restricted speech of, it seems to be, in my mind, leaning towards people who are on the right more than on the left, censoring speech. What are your thoughts on that? Should government get involved in that? How do we approach this, and what can be done?
I'm a First Amendment free speech advocate, but that doesn't mean that I have to agree with everything that anybody else and tweets or posts on Facebook or writes or says out there. Some of it's pretty awful, but the First Amendment protects awful speech. Doesn't mean I have to agree with it, and it means that I can also denounce it, and I do announce a lot of that hate. When it comes to Facebook and Twitter, they are private companies, and they can set their own standards, I guess. Just like if you were in your house and people started saying some pretty awful things in front of your children, you could say, don't say that in my house. And if they don't comply, you can show them the door. You know, it's a private residence you have, and then it's a private. These are private platforms. But I don't want to go down the road where the government is starting to create some kind of manual about what can be said and what can't be said. I mean, certainly, you know, when it comes to inciting violence, that's totally different. You know, yelling fire into theater and that kind of thing.
Right.
But I think the government needs to protect speech, even if people don't agree with it and think it may be awful. But, you know, shame those. Just the public populace can shame those on their own with what they agree with and don't agree with, and reject that. But I don't want the government, you know, starting down that Orwellian road of what can be said and can't be said out there, and then forcing those companies as well.
Right. You know, one of the points that people are bringing up with when it comes to, you know, regulation, and I agree with you, by the way, I they are private companies. I'd hate to see government start regulating, because that's a double-edged sword that, you know, might help conservatives right now, but that down the road can end up biting us in the rear end too. what the talks is should we continue to look at Google and Facebook and Twitter as platforms, or are they now publishers that are sent, you know, that have a particular agenda that are censoring speech? And if they're publishers, then they could potentially be open up to, you know, civil
responsibility
right.
and legal issues and liability. Yeah. So that's an interesting debate, and I have not, you know, really taken a deep dive on that. But if they, you're right. I mean, then are they liable for something that could happen? Let's say there was a threat or somebody was being bullied. I mean, and if it's on their platform, are they liable if they're a publisher? That's a great question. And that debate is happening, and I think it will continue to be a debate for some time.
Okay. We had, tax reform was passed a little while ago, or no, about a year ago or 2 years ago, and now I can't remember. But what, if elected to Congress, you know, what would you like to do to see that to further address tax reform, and what more can be done? And are you satisfied, dissatisfied with the current tax climate?
Well, we see what's happening with our economy, and a lot of it is because of not just tax relief for individuals and small businesses and larger employers as well, but also because of the many rules and regulations that we repealed as well. And so I would like to see the tax relief made permanent. I voted to make it permanent last fall before leaving office. And, you know, Cindy Axne says she wants to repeal the tax bill and the tax relief, which would be what? Then you would be raising taxes. And we don't need to be raising taxes on Iowans and in this country right now. And so, you know, when it comes to taxes, I like to keep them low because I trust people with their money, and they know how to spend it better than the government. And when you cut taxes, you grow the economy. You people invest their money. They create more jobs. More jobs mean more taxpayers. That's more revenue. I just want to see when that revenue comes in that it's used to drive down the debt and deficit. And we're seeing a lot of programs right now which have a pretty high price tag on them when it comes to those programs, such as a Green New Deal, or Medicare for All, which is really Medicare for None at $32 trillion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, politicians are always looking for a way to get people's money, and I trust people with their money.
I don't know how much time you have, so I want to just kind of, you know, wrap it up just to respect your time. But a couple questions I have to wrap up. One, Congress, or at least the House, is set to vote on the Equality Act, I believe, next week, which would add sexual identity and, or excuse me, sexual orientation and gender identity to the Civil Rights Act, as well as a various other federal law, and also restrict the use of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act when applied to these kinds of cases. What's your view on that? Should sexual orientation and gender identity be a protected class in federal law? And what can be done to better, you know, protect religious liberty?
Well, you know, that's the thing that I look at through this lens, and that is, you know, religious liberty and religious freedom and people of faith. This isn't just about, we're all a compassionate people, Republicans, conservatives. We don't want to see, you know, people bullied or discriminated against with. People are who they are, and you just kind of, in my biblical perspective, you treat people with love and kindness. But we need to make sure that our religious liberty and our religious freedoms are protected. And I think this bill that they're talking about, I think it amends the Civil Rights Act and Religious Freedom Restoration Act in maybe 10 or 12 different dozens of ways. And what does that do to maybe nonprofits or churches or your religious-based employers? And so I think we need to first and foremost make sure that we are protecting the First Amendment and our religious liberties and freedoms, and people's deep religious convictions are very, very personal and very valuable to them, and we don't want to see those infringed on, and that's why we celebrate the First Amendment. But I don't know when that if it's been considered or not or what it will be, but I know that's one of the things that is the priorities of Nancy Pelosi in this
Congress. Right. Right. It's going to, I'm sure it's going to pass the House. It probably won't pass the Senate, but I don't know if the next Congress, if you happen to be elected, if it's going to, you know, if they'll bring it back up or not. So
who knows what the issues will be, you know, any day, it seems, or any given week.
Right. Right. So second last question. Then I got to ask you the coffee question, like I ask every candidate. Life. What can be done to finally maybe advance the life issue in Congress? It seems like we've just really gone nowhere. And what kinds of bills do you support?
I believe that God is the giver of life and the taker of life, and I'm proud of my pro-life convictions and voting record and stance. And it used to be the conversation was just about, you know, taxpayer funding of abortions. And fortunately, whenever we did our appropriations bills, we made sure that that Hyde language was in there, named after Henry Hyde, who you're mm-hmm. familiar with, which said no taxpayer dollars should be used for abortions. But, you know, the debate is not about exceptions anymore. It's all about limits. I mean, where is the limit? I mean, the majority, even people who maybe consider themselves pro-choice, they're not for third trimester abortions or partial birth abortions. And then you see what's going on in with the governor of Virginia, what he said, and what they're doing in New York, where even after a baby is delivered, to have the conversation and thought that, you know, you can still terminate that, which isn't a pregnancy anymore. It's a life now.
Right.
And that scares me. And I don't think people, you know, understand the implications of that. And if, you know, if they make that decision 3 minutes after the child was born, who says they can't make it 3 months after the child is born? I don't know. I think it's going down the wrong path. And I just pray that people learn more about this and come back to their convictions about what life is about and how it should be valued and who the giver of life is.
Right. Well, thank you. I'd be remiss to not to ask you, since this is the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast, what is your favorite coffee drink?
Well, there were the days where I liked, you know, the flavored drinks. But today it's, you know, about three cups in the morning of just give me hot black coffee, just pour it down the hatch and get me going. And then my next caffeine delivery device is about 3 Diet Mountain Dews. So that's it.
So do you grind your own coffee, or do you just, you know, have it ground yourself?
I've got those little pods, and I do that, or, you know, okay. Casey's or Come and Go or my best friend on some mornings.
All right. Well, Congressman, thank you so much for taking the time, and we'll obviously have to have you back on as we get closer to the primaries and the general election, should you be nominated. So I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you, and just to your listeners, the people of Iowa in the 3rd District, they know me. I know them. They know my record. We've won this twice before. I think the conservatives and Republicans have woken up as to what happens if you don't get organized and get out there to vote. And this district, this 3rd District, was not realigned to the Democrat side because she didn't even get 50% of the vote. And so we can get this back, but folks, you got to get out there, you got to vote, and I'm asking for your vote.
All right, well, thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
Shane, thank you. You be good. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's caffeinated, CAFFEINATED, thoughts.com, or just Google Caffeinated Thoughts, and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. We may have a podcast, but we blog way more than we podcast, so you want to be sure to check that out. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our email updates. That way you don't miss a single update, single article. Also, we want to encourage you to, if you like listening to our podcast and podcast apps, there are a variety of different ways to do that. We're on Apple's podcast,
Apple Podcasts, excuse me. We're on Stitcher. We're on Spotify. We're on SoundCloud. We are on Podbean. We are on Google Play. If there's a podcast app that I'm missing, you know, be sure to let me know. Again, shoot me an email, shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com, and say, hey, can you try to get your podcast on whatever app we're not on? So, but I think for the vast majority of you, we're probably on whatever, you know, podcast app you do use. So I hope you subscribe to us. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please be sure to give us or listen to us on iTunes. Please give us a 5-star rating. We'd appreciate it if you like what you hear. Until next time, my friends. Hey, this is Shane Vanderhart with the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. See you next time.